the Empire podcast this week, Michael Sheen drops by and I don't make a single furniture polish related pun. That's my pledge to you. Plus, Rachel Fice drops by to talk my cousin Rachel. All that unusual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. I would like to congratulate Senator Palpatine on his victory over Chancellor Falorum in the recent elections. You know, trust me. That guy has our best interests at heart. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up, this is rather weird because this week on Twitter, a Twitter user called Mindy Moo asked, when is Dan Jolin doing an Empire Podcast? I still crack up at his giant ant comment from the Ant-Man spoiler special. And lo and behold, as if by magic, he honestly didn't fix it like this. Here he is, Dan Jolin. Hello.
Hello. Well, Chris doesn't think he fixed it like this, but I'm here for you, Mindy. For you and nobody else.
There we go.
That was maybe a bit, no.
I don't remember the giant ant comment, but I'm sure it was very funny, Dan. I'm sure it was very funny.
I think it was something to do with a dog-sized ant and how it was supposed to be cute and how, in reality, a dog-sized ant would be hideous and terrifying.
Okay. All right. Good. Last but not least on the podcast is one of the most powerful ladies I know. How powerful is she? She could take on the alien queen without a power loader. That's how powerful. It's our editor-in-chief, Terry White. Bow before her, you dogs!
Hi, Chris. Don't sound very powerful. I feel like I'm only the most powerful woman in the room because Helen O'Hara is, in fact, not here.
That's not true. If Helen were here, you would still be the most powerful woman in the room.
In my bit of the room.
in that specific segment of the room. No, but we would never want to see you fight.
Oh, God.
Who would you bet on, Chris?
Sorry, Dan, I'm taking a long drink of water.
Okay.
Yeah, can we just say, Dan, you are not full-time employed by me anymore where Chris is. So I feel like you've got an unfair advantage in this discussion.
Yeah. This could be the first on-air firing. This would be brilliant.
That would be great. I'd love it.
Terry,
you would win.
But then here's the thing, right? You are not to stereotype in any way, but you are from the north of England.
Yes.
Right? So you've got a bit of scrap about you.
Okay. My council estate.
Yeah.
In
absolutely.
The north of England.
Chudde and all that.
Chudde.
Return of the Chudde. And Helen.
The last Chudde.
Helen. Helen is, you know, she's from my neck of the woods, you know, a bit further away than you know, where I grew up. But she's Northern Irish. So she's got something about her as well.
Mm.
Although I'd say Helen is perhaps more. She's a trained barrister and maybe she's someone who would war with words, whereas I can imagine you just getting a coat hanger, a metal coat hanger, and unspooling it and then just having a go.
Yeah, you see, I'd start with words and then when I sensed that Helen was trouncing me, I'd just probably grab the nearest bottle or coat hanger or whatever was to hand, really, Chris.
Doorknobs in a pillowcase?
Doorknobs in a pillowcase, maybe. Yeah.
Snooker balls in a sock.
Anytime I get to do a Ray Winston is good by me. So,
I'm the daddy now, yells daddy. Terry.
Mummy, I'm the mummy daddy now.
as I slowly soil myself in the corner. Of course, this is not going to happen, but should, for example, Terry and Helen face off in public, I'm trying to think of when the best time for that to happen might be. It might be Saturday, September 16th, when we are doing our live podcast at the London Podcast Festival, which is an amazing event that takes place in September over the weekend of that weekend in September. It's at King's Place in London, and it brings together some amazing podcasters from around the world. My Dad Wrote a Porno is going to be doing an event. The Guardian's Football Weekly will be doing an event. John Hodgman, with over a million Twitter listeners, will be doing an event. And we are, weirdly enough, closing the Saturday night. And you can book tickets right now if you go to the King's Place website. I should have a URL, but I'm not that slick or prepared. But go to the King's Place website and you can book tickets and you can book a multiple pass for more than one ticket, for more than one event, and therefore you can get a discount. But come and see us. Come and see us Saturday, September 16th. Terry and Helen will fight.
There you go. There's
that is a promise.
That is my promise
That's
to you.
That's loaded into the ticket price.
It's sorted. It's happening. It's real. All right. Should we have a question?
Yeah.
This is from Matthew Dashper Hughes via email. It's a fairly long question about how a bunch of cinemas showed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest recently to celebrate Jack Nicholson's 80th birthday, and they have a cinema club in his small town where you have to answer two interrelated questions. What's the one film you've never seen on the big screen that you really want to see on the big screen, and what's the one film you think everyone has to see at least once? So, okay, let's take those. Let's take those both. What's the one film you've never seen on the big screen that you really want to see? And what's the one film you think everyone has to see at least once? Terry.
So the film I haven't seen on the big screen that I'd like to see is Rocky 2.
Okay.
I hate to take it back to the Rocky franchise yet again. But I've seen the Rocky. I first watched Rocky on VHS in a little room above the pub my mum used to work in. And when she was working behind the bar, me and my brother would sit and watch the Rocky films over and over and over again on a tiny little telly. And as I've got older, the tellies have grown bigger. But for some reason, I've never seen any of the Rocky franchise at the pictures.
Really?
At
what about
any
Creed?
Of them, apart from Creed.
Okay,
apart from Creed.
Okay.
So I should clarify, Rocky 2, Rocky 3, Rocky 4, Rocky 5 doesn't exist, thank you very much.
Okay.
Or Rocky Balboa, I haven't seen any of them on the cinema screen, I've only seen Creed. But I think Rocky 2, and anybody who's heard me on the podcast before will know that I have strong feelings about the Rocky franchise, but the boxing coordination in Rocky 2 specifically is astonishing. And I think watching that massive up close, hearing every punch land would be an experience that I would really love. Have either of you guys seen it?
Yeah.
The pictures?
Not the pictures, but...
Oh, no.
Not ever, Dan.
Of course.
You may not have heard of this little film called Rocky.
Is that the one where he does the fights? Yes, in that case, I have seen it. I have seen Rocky V at the pictures. I saw it at the Ivy Cinema in Banbridge, Northern Ireland. I saw Rocky Balboa here whenever I was working at Empire, and Creed a couple of times. But I've never seen... Rocky 4 is probably the one I gravitate most towards. That's the one that I watched most on VHS when it came out. And it speaks to me on a number of levels.
That was my first cinematic Rocky 4.
Really?
Yeah. The bit at the end where all the Soviet guys all stood up and applauded him. Oh, man, that was amazing.
Was it? I mean, I'm not even going to say it's a metaphor for the Cold War because it was, you know, if these can come together and we, this is Italian-American, by the way, and we can come together, we can all come together. But is it amazing? I think that was very good.
Okay.
The thing about Rocky IV at the big screen is I imagine the montages, because obviously Rocky IV is essentially one long montage. And obviously after the death of Apollo Creed, it pretty much goes from No Easy Way Out, which is when he's grieving, straight into pretty much the training montage, which is Hearts on Fire.
Mm-hmm.
That is pretty much back to back. I imagine on a big screen that kind of 10 minutes is
not as good as the James Brown bit at the beginning.
Oh,
yeah, living in America. The whole he's there on stage performing. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like being at a James Brown concert.
Yeah, so that would be my answer on that. And in terms of a film that, what was the other part of the question? A film you think
everyone should see on the big screen. Rocky 2, Rocky 3.
Yeah, so as I was just saying. No, Kill Bill and Kill Bill Volume 2, actually. Kill Bill Volumes 1 and 2, I think, is made for the cinema screen, I think. In terms of the fight scenes, in terms of the use of anime, the use of colour, the use of music. I mean, it is such an assault on the senses. And I think the impact of those films is actually really lost when you watch it on the small screen. And when you go and you see it at the cinema and you fully kind of immerse yourself in it, I think it's a completely different experience having that at the pictures.
So you think you would go for more of a visual, crowd-pleasing exercise and perhaps something that is very art housey, like 2001 70mm, which I saw years ago.
I'm not Phil Dissemblian.
Bored off my tits.
Phil Dissemblian, am I? I am about...
You're not.
No, I'm not. You see, for me, the cinema is for me when I really want to immerse myself in a film. There is nothing like the lights going down and that kind of full-bodied, very visceral experience you have in the cinema. So for me, the louder, the brighter, the, you know, more OTT, the better. So that's what I want. And that's my favourite cinema-going experiences are very much that.
Would you want Dan with you?
Always.
Dan enhances every cinematic experience.
And that's because what I do is I go to the loo about three times and then I come back in and then I say, what did I miss?
Yes.
What did I miss? And it makes you feel involved.
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
Except when I have to chaperone you to the toilet because you're, you know, you get a bit older, Dan, aren't you? You need to go a little bit more.
Thanks, Chris.
You need to be shown where it is.
Yeah. It's all right, I'll deal with it. I've got ways to deal with it.
All right.
How many times did you go the other day during the...
Twice.
We were at a screening together, Dan and I, and I think we managed to get 25 minutes into the film before I saw you pop up and off you trotted.
But it's an early morning screening and I just had a coffee.
Have you thought about... I mean, we may be getting off the beaten path here, but have you thought about bringing a catheter with you? And just...
I've never met her.
Just getting through the movie. Just experiencing
apparently,
the film.
You can get grown-up nappies. I've been told.
You can.
Yeah, I asked for a friend.
Right, okay, so...
Hello.
Dan.
Hello. I'm going to shock you, Chris.
Can I just shock you? I like red wine.
I don't think I've seen any of my favouritest ever films in the world at the cinema.
Okay, Brazil?
Never seen it at the cinema.
Planet of the Brazil?
Never seen it at the Brazilian bar.
Brazil of the Apes?
Never seen that at the cinema.
What else do you like?
The Good, the Bad and the Ugly.
50 Shades of Grey.
Never seen it at the cinema.
Really?
Aliens. Never seen it at the cinema.
I've never seen Aliens at the cinema. Should we go?
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Ooh.
Never seen it.
That's
at
exciting.
The cinema.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I think you can get most of the way through my top 10. Goodfellas. Never seen it at the cinema.
Goodfellas played Screen on the Green in London, London's Islington recently.
No, but I was talking about this earlier. So James Dyer, you know James Dyer?
Yes,
James Dyer.
Yeah.
Tall, bald, supercilious.
Yeah.
He's like Crichton and Rimmer combined from Red Dwarf. Anyway, don't you think?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I was talking to him earlier, and I was saying that it's kind of like we're the generation that discovered all our favourite films on VHS, aren't we, really?
Mm.
You know, we
Speak
where
yourself,
we,
Dan,
we
I
came of age cinematically.
Because I'm so young. not VHS.
But yeah, so it was kind of like everything was video, 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 and it was all what you got down video shop, and you rewatched things with your friends in front rooms. Mm-hmm. And then it was almost like you kind of graduated onto cinema from that. In a weird way.
Yeah.
So yeah, all the films that I love that I discovered for the first time. Apocalypse Now I have seen on the big screen though, thanks to the Redux.
Oh, so you saw the Redux, but not the original version?
Not the original, no. And I would say that Apocalypse Now is a film you do have to see on the big screen.
Like Mrs. Brown's Boys the movie?
Not like that at all.
Okay.
The exact opposite of that. You're thinking the exact opposite, in fact.
All right, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. The other end of the spectrum. So yeah, I'm going to say Apocalypse Now would be my one I think that you have to see. Redux or original. You know, when those helicopter blade noises come in at the beginning.
Yeah,
you've got them going around the cinema, going around your head.
Oh,
and
that's
there.
Nice. That's nice.
Shit. I'm in Saigon. I'm still in Saigon.
You done? I've seen some of my favourite movies on the big screen. It's great. It's fantastic. You know, you see new things. Things are bigger. For example, I saw Alien recently. It was a slightly pink 70mm print at the Picture House Central. I had no idea Sigourney Weaver was that tall. It's mad. Absolutely
mad. No, she just projected big.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
In reality, she's 4'2".
All right, there you go. I've seen Evil Dead 2 in the big screen. That was a lot of fun. I think it was just a DVD that they projected on the screen, but hey-ho, what can you do? I don't know. I think the answer to this, I've got one answer to both. The film that, you know, I haven't seen the big screen is the film that you should also see, and it's obviously The Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant. I think everyone should go and see that at their earliest convenience. Right. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire Podcast, you can do so via a number of ways. You can tweet us where we're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can Facebook us where we're Empire Magazine as well. And you can email us podcast@empireonline.com. It's all very exciting. Speaking of exciting, time now for our first guest. Michael Sheen is one of our finest actors, as you might expect, given that he heralds from Port Talbot in Wales, which is home of Tony Hopkins and Richard Burton, who are the same person, apparently. His new movie, Norman.
Rob Brydon.
Apparently he comes from there as well.
Yeah, no,
who knew?
He does.
Who knew?
He really does.
Rob Brydon.
Yeah.
Oh. His new movie. Michael Sheen's new movie, Norman, The Moderate Rise and Tragic Fall of a New York Fixer, which probably has a year's longest title, is out today, in which he co-stars with one Richard Gere. And he, Michael Sheen, that is not Richard Gere, popped into our pod booth this week, fresh from completing filming on Gareth Evans' new movie, Apostle. Guess where? Port Talbot in Wales. What are the odds? And we nodded about all sorts of stuff, from that to Stephen King, to acting, Richard Gere, tons of... I can't remember what we talked about. It was really, really good. Enjoy it. Here's Michael Sheen. We're delighted to be joined on the EPRA podcast by the great Michael Sheen. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. Glad to have you here. You've just finished filming on your home turf.
Yeah. I've spent the last few months doing a film in Port Talbot, my hometown.
How was that?
It was great. Yeah. Weird. It was great. I have worked in Port Talbot before. I did a theatre project there about 6 years ago now called The Passion. Mm-hmm. So it's not completely new, you know, sort of doing my day job in my hometown. But I've never filmed there before like this. So, you know, going to have wardrobe calls and makeup and stuff at home was just weird, but beautiful. I mean, we filmed in places that I knew about, but I'd never really gone to that much, and it was a revelation. Yeah. Amazing places around there to film in. Yeah, beautiful. So it was great.
It's kind of strange. You can grow up in a place and not really know it, I find.
Yeah.
There's always these little hidden nooks and crannies that you maybe haven't explored.
Yeah, I always had a sort of siege mentality when I was living in Port Talbot. I just never went anywhere else, really.
Oh, really? Okay.
So just outside Port Talbot are all these amazing, beautiful landscapes and weird places. And the film is a film called Apostle that Gareth Evans has written and directed. And so it's got this sort of strange combination of qualities as he is a fan of, coming from sort of Asian cinema.
Yes, of course.
We've got this new hybrid now, Asian-Welsh cinema, that we're going to be doing. So there's all these odd things that, you know, in Western film you don't see going together as much.
Yeah.
And that was part of what I love. So, you know, taking lots of what could be very beautiful places to film in and then messing with them.
Amazing, amazing. So did you stay at the Sheen family home? Did you...
Well, my mum is recovering from a hip replacement operation. Oh. So she's kicked Dad out of bed.
Okay.
Not literally, because she can't, because of her hip. But he's sleeping in my room. And so I had to go and stay in a hotel.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so hotel living life in Port Talbot.
Living la vida loca. It's,
yeah.
It's kind of amazing. As we were just saying beforehand, I was actually meant to be visiting you guys last week, and this damned cold that you can hear stopped me in my tracks. But what can you say at this point about Apostle? Because I think a lot of people hear Gareth Evans' name, and they think bloody, they think violence, they think bloody violence. And I imagine there will be that, but this feels like it's something new as well.
It's bloody violence plus religion.
Okay.
I mean, what I like, when I read the script, I've been sort of keeping an eye on Gareth, I suppose, you know, because when the first Raid film came out, you know, I was reading a review of it or something, and then when it said, Gareth Evans, director from Hirwaun. I was like, hang on, what? That doesn't work. I thought The Raid was fantastic. And so I've been, you know, very interested in what he's been doing. Uh-huh. And so then when I got sent this script, which is very different from The Raid, or The Raid 2, it's set in 1905. It's about a cult who... Dan Stevens' character has to rescue his sister from, and I play the cult leader. And there's all kinds of weird stuff going on. So the cult are set up on this island off the coast of Britain.
Yeah.
I don't really know where. Once Dan comes over, then it all gets a bit wicker.
I'm very excited.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see
it. And it is, you know, I think Gareth has brought a kind of... a sort of Asian cinema sensibility to it in some ways. So so there are all these elements that you don't normally see go together in a British film, and they're all in there. And you know, particularly in the kind of action sequences, you can see the influence of the other films that he's done. So it's really exciting. We just had a rap party the end of last week, and you know, they do a sort of sizzle reel of stuff that they've put together, because that's the other thing, Gareth edits as he's going along, which is extraordinary. So we saw all these things, and suddenly he kind of went, oh, it makes sense now. Okay, so it was great. And they built this whole village in the local park in Markham Park, which was incredibly exciting, I mean, I would have happily lived in one of the houses that they built. That's not possible.
Rather than the hotel.
Rather than the hotel, yeah. I would have quite happily. It would have been a bit cold, but it was
living
nice.
It up, yeah. Demanding room service.
But it was weird to be filming these sequences with literally just about 50 feet away is where my daughter has, you know, swung in the trees. There's a thing called Go Ape, which is a kind of up in the trees adventure place for kids. And it is weird to be doing all the things that I was doing in the film, which I won't, you know, give any spoilers, but just literally a minute away from where my daughter's done, you know, a zip line through the trees in Morgan Park.
But growing up, you were talking about, you know, heroes as well and people you look up to. And, you know, was Richard Gere one of those people?
I can't say he was, uh-huh. to be honest. I mean, you know, obviously I grew up with him being the kind of number one heartthrob in
the
world,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah.
So, it's sort of similar to people like Robert Redford, maybe not quite so much Paul Newman, but you know, people who were just film stars. They were film stars, and their acting style didn't necessarily jump out at you as great acting to begin with. Mm. And then people who I've come to appreciate more and more as I've got older as being genuinely brilliant actors. But they had a kind of ease about them and a charm about them, I suppose, that that wasn't drawing attention to the acting so much. And so as time has gone on, I've sort of come to appreciate what they did in those kind of classic films when I was growing up more and more. And I suppose watching, you know, work that Richard did with Terrence Malick and you know, people like that, you start to say, oh, I see, no, you're serious.
Yeah.
And then working with him on this film, Norman, that's coming out now, the first day when I went there to do my first scene on it, and I hadn't met Richard before that, and you know, you get to do a little rehearsal,
yeah.
you know, a bit of rehearsing before you shoot the scene, and I could just tell this was a guy who was in the zone. You know, sometimes you just see it, you know, like characters that are just perfectly formed, and you realize that this person is totally in this character, and it's just something special about it. And I could tell that's what was going on with him in this film, and I think he's remarkable in it. It's a really remarkable performance for someone who has been known for being so charming, and he is charming, but in a totally different way. You know, he is likable, but in a totally different way to what you've ever seen him do before. I buy what he's selling in it.
He's in a really interesting spot in his career. He's doing films like this and Arbitrage and Time Out of Mind, which are completely, I wouldn't say Richard Gere-esque characters, not people you think of. And I think he's aging very well on screen in that way. He's taking different roles and trying different things.
Yeah, he's becoming a character actor.
Yeah.
It's interesting that, you know, people have described me as character actor, Michael Sheen. And he's kind of, is that a bit of a put down? Or is it, how do I feel about that? And it's interesting, you know, a lot of actors who become that kind of heartthrob leading man, like Brad Pitt, Johnny Depp, Richard, I suppose, as well. You know, you can see that they're actually character actors who are struggling against the leading man thing. You know, you look at Brad in something like 12 Monkeys, you know, I think he's fantastic in that. Mm. And really, you know, he takes risks as an actor when he's able to. And, you know, and in the Tarantino stuff as well, I suppose, you know, you can see him pushing against what he would normally be cast as. And, you know, Johnny Depp has done that all his career, really, I suppose. And it is interesting when actors get, you know, in order to reach and maintain a level of success in your career and all the sort of choice that comes with that, you do have to limit your choice in other ways, I suppose, you know, for people like that, for people who are doing what they've done. That must be difficult in just as an actor. I mean, you know, it's not difficult in other ways, but it must be difficult as an actor if you genuinely want to play, take risks and have fun with characters and not do just straight down the line kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Then I suppose you do have to make a choice. It's not a choice I've ever had to make, to be honest, but I suppose you do have to make a choice that, you know, do I want to be playing in the Premiership League? You know, always doing the same kind of thing?
Yeah.
Or do I want to be, you know, maybe I move down a division But I get to do all kinds of really interesting stuff, and I'm much happier as an actor. Yeah. You know, I don't know. That must be tough for him. But I think Richard is definitely coming into a point now where he is really, you know, doing all kinds of different stuff. You know, I thought it was fantastic when Ian McKellen had got to a point where clearly he had done everything he'd wanted to do and was like, right, now I want to do Coronation Street. Now I want to do a panto. Now I want to be on a, you know, like, that's just so liberating and exhilarating to see someone just kind of going, I, you know, I've got nothing to prove.
Yeah, precisely.
Now I'm just going to do the stuff that I really enjoy doing.
It's amazing. And now that Masters of Sex has finished, what's next for you? Are you planning to do more films? Are you looking for another TV show? Or are you going to do Coronation Street, a panto, a Shakespeare app? Are you going to follow in McKellen's footsteps?
A bit of that. I mean, I suppose a bit of that. I've got to a point in my life and in my career, I suppose, where I'm sort of, you know, having a bit of a shift now, a focus, where, you know, I've spent a lot of time in the US over the last sort of 15 years because my daughter has grown up there. And so, you know, I wanted to be an integral part of my daughter's life, so I had to go and live over there. And now, you know, and I've come back and forth a lot, but that's had obviously a big effect on my life and my career. And it's gone well, you know, it's been great, and I'm glad it's worked out. But it's not what I would have ever have planned, really. Mm-hmm. And so now she's 18 and she's going off to college, and. So that's opening all kinds of doors for me now, really. You know, I'm able to come back here now, and focus on my life over here a lot more, which is great. But also, the stuff I've been doing over the last sort of 6-7 years has become more and more personal, I suppose, and more connected to the community that I've come from, and that's led me now to wanting to do less acting and more sort of direct stuff in the community that I come from and get involved in that kind of stuff more. So now I'm sort of trying to find a new balance in my life where, you know, a lot of the kind of leverage that I have in doing the other stuff comes because of the work acting. I've done as an actor. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not going to, it would be counterproductive for me to let that go. But I think it's going to support the other stuff now rather than the other way around. And so I've got to try and find a balance where I've got enough time to be able to do the stuff that I'm really focused on doing now. But at the same time, keep my hand in with things so that, you know, it gives me the leverage.
You must have loved having to put out the fires last year when people misinterpreted your comments about acting and coming back.
It wasn't
here.
A misinterpretation. The problem with newspapers are that the person you do the interview with doesn't get to choose what the headline is.
True.
And so they can just make up whatever they want in the headline. Of course, that's the thing that gets people's attention. That's why they do it. So when someone just makes up a headline that is not true, then it doesn't matter what it says in the article.
Yeah.
The thing that people remember is that. So, yeah, so me going off to fight Nazis in Port Talbot was slightly overstated. So the truth is, like I say, that there's a shift and, you know, I'm trying to find a different kind of balance and it's going to take a while to do that. But my interest is going in a different direction now.
So is directing still on the agenda for you?
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a big commitment. That's, you know, turning up to do a bit of acting is one thing, but, you know. When you've written and directed, and you're going to direct something, then that is years of your life. So I hope it is. Yeah, you know, I've been writing a bit for the last few years, and I've really wanted to direct something as well. Although it was the writing that was the thing that really drew me to it, and then once I'd written the script, I realized that I'd written what I was seeing in my head so much, and I thought, I don't really want to give this to anyone else now.
Oh, really? Okay.
I want to do this myself.
And this is a Green River Killer.
Green River Killer. And so I really hope that I do get the opportunity to do that. But it's a long old commitment. It's a big commitment.
Especially if you're writing, directing, acting in it as well.
Well, that's the plan. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I am very. From the very beginning of working on that, when I was doing the research and all that kind of stuff, I am very, very torn by, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there about serial killers and, you know, that thing of the idea of creating an entertainment based on people suffering, I'm very against, to be honest, or certainly very conflicted about. And the idea of somehow, you know, creating a kind of roller coaster ride for people based on exploiting people's pain and suffering, I very, very ambiguous feelings about it. And I completely understand why people sort of get very, very concerned about it and very angry about it. And so I've been really torn by that from the beginning of the project. Yeah. And I think you do have a real responsibility if you're going to enter that area, in how you portray it and what you're really doing and why you're doing it and that kind of stuff. So it is something that I think about a lot all the time. And when you put that next to also the time commitment and just how difficult it is to get anything made, to be honest, I mean, that's what I'm realizing more and more. So we'll see what happens. I hope it does work out. I do.
I wish you all the best. And are you keeping an eye still on what Tony Blair is up to, just in case?
Well, there's a whole new chapter, isn't there, coming up?
It certainly is.
Is he going to return to the actual fray of politics? I can't honestly see myself doing. I think that's a trilogy that's done. You never say never.
You never say never. That would be intriguing, but we shall see. Michael Sheen, I will let you go. Thank you so much indeed. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers.
Thank you. The lovely Michael Sheen there. And now it is time to talk about this week's movie news. What's been happening?
David Harbour was talking a bit more about his Hellboy.
Okay.
Which interests me, because I think I'm going to shock you again. Can I shock you again?
Yes, go
on. I really like the sound of this new Hellboy. I know it's not Guillermo, and I know it's not Ron, but I think David Harbour's really good casting.
Yes, he is. He is good casting. Do you see the picture this week that Patton Oswalt
took
him with Ron Perlman and David Harbour? So if there was indeed any hatchet to bury, the hatchet has been buried, which is good.
Good old Patton.
Yeah, bringing people together.
That's what I like. That's all I like. But yeah, no, I just kind of, I've been watching this one interestingly because Neil Marshall is obviously directing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, his film The Descent was one of my favourite films of the noughties. What do we call them now? The noughties?
Noughties.
The aughts? The zeros.
The noughties. I mean, it's all awful.
We do say noughties. Fine. So it's one of my favourite films of the noughties. So I think he's a really good choice for it as well. And of course, I've been loving his work on Game of Thrones. But yeah, no, David Harbour was just talking a little bit more about it. I think he's very excited about it and was comparing it with his character in Stranger Things, funnily enough.
Oh, really?
Yeah, talking about him being an anti-hero and comparing him with Chief Hopper. A kind of, he's not a do-gooder, but he ends up doing good. Which so it kind of reassured me further. But I think physically, he's got, well, literally the chops to do it. Big, big Hellboy chops.
Yes, indeed.
So, yeah.
There we go. Exciting. Yeah. Exciting times. I'm excited about that. It is a shame, obviously, that Guillermo's not directed it, but hey, oh.
What are you going to do, Chris?
What are you going to do?
What can we do about it?
I don't know. We're powerless. We can crowdfund a fan fiction film.
Yeah. Directed by Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah. But not call it Hellboy because of rights issues. But
we could call it Bellhoy.
Yes, Dan. That's exactly what we'll call it.
The most Dan suggestion ever.
Angel Girl.
Angel Girl.
Yeah.
There we go. No one will suspect. No one will see that one coming.
She comes down from heaven and she fights, I don't know, babies.
The deadliest foes.
Yes. Evil babies.
Or just babies.
Yeah.
Right. So that's that. One tick. Boom. Done. Terry, anything happening in your world this week?
Yes. So I was super excited about this Michael B. Jordan and Ryan Coogler project, which will be their fourth time together. I think it was something, I think Coogler was interviewed in the New York Times and kind of basically dropped a little bit of information about, it's called Wrong Answer. Now, obviously, these guys have done Creed together. They are still shooting, I believe, Black Panther at the moment, which I recently went on set of.
What?
Just dropping that, guys. Let it rest. Freeville Station and Wrong Answer. It's a little bit of a departure for them. So it's about a real-life school cheating scandal. Michael B. Jordan plays a Atlanta school teacher who basically helps students cheat. And they were kind of charged and faced a long time in prison. So it's not necessarily what you'd expect from these two guys next. But I think their partnership clearly works and is really, really exciting. I think he's a really interesting filmmaker. And I think obviously him and Michael B. Jordan have an amazing alchemy together. I think Creed kind of really showed a completely different take on that franchise from a completely new actor, a completely new director, gave it complete new life. So I have a great deal of faith in anything they do. So no date on this, no idea of when it's coming, but I'm excited.
Does this mean that Creed 2 or Rocky 8 is not going to happen?
Gosh.
It feels that way, doesn't it? It feels like it may have just slightly...
Perhaps they're going to wait for him to get really old.
What, Michael B. Jordan?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it'll be like the other end of the sketch. So he'll be really old and he'll have another.
He has to train a 130-year-old Rocky to get back in the ring.
Yes.
One last time.
That's it.
Do you think they'd ever kill Rocky off and then?
Oh no!
I had to go there. But can you imagine? Like the next film is he's died. Sorry, I'm going with this now.
Right.
Rocky's died, and it's about him, Creed, taking on not just his father's legacy.
Yeah.
As a fighter, but Rocky's legacy. Put those two things together and you've got the best film ever.
Absolutely. I like the sound of that. And he could fight babies.
Would Rocky be a ghost? Like a force ghost that would appear? And
oh, that'd be amazing. Could also Adrian be a ghost? Because, and actually, if just bring them all back, Paulie, Adrian, like let's bring the whole cast back as ghosts.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it. Let's do it. Let's get on it. Let's make it happen.
Yeah.
Can Ghost Rocky fight Mark Rylance? and finally, at the end, he defeats him and he picks up the Oscar that should have been his and he holds it aloft. I mean...
Sorry, you think it should have been Stallone's?
It should have been Stallone's, yes.
Not Rylance's?
No. And I'd say that to Rylance's face.
Next time you see him.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'd poke Dunkirk comes around.
I'd poke off that stupid pork pie hat of his. I'd knock it to the ground. I'd say, "Oi, Rylance, give that Oscar to Stallone, mate." I'm very, very sorry, sir.
When it comes to pork pie hats,
let me replace your hat.
Like that's a. I'm not saying you wear a pork pie, but there's a lot of pork pie going on in that scenario.
There's a lot of pork pie. Yeah,
there's a lot of pork pie going on in that scenario.
What's happening?
There's a lot of pork pie going on in that scenario.
Oh, I can see the tweets now. Helen O'Hara has left the Empire podcast for 1 week and people are doing weird accents and threatening Mark Rylance for physical violence. Yeah,
that rhymes.
And killing off Rocky.
A History of Rylance.
There
oh
you go.
God.
Oh, my God.
Feature headline.
It's all happening. Yes. Ghost Stallone versus Rylance.
Yeah.
I'm bang up for that. Tom Cruise announced last week that Top Gun 2 is still on his to-do list, along with, you know, being just awesome. He's going to do Top Gun, and it's called Maverick. Top Gun Maverick.
Maverick.
Yeah. What do we think about this? Is this exciting?
I don't know. He just seems to just be playing Maverick in most films anyway, still. So
yes.
No, but really?
Yeah, there are shades of it in The Mummy, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, what's the story here? I mean, what was the story in Top Gun?
Can you remember?
I
watched this movie from my sick bed on the sofa this week, and so I faded in and out of consciousness.
Yeah.
No, I don't remember. No.
I mean, maybe the numbers of young men joining the American Air Force has dropped sufficiently that they need another advert. Perhaps that's what it is.
Yes, yes.
Well, he'll now be one of the trainers, I presume, right? And he was, you know, always railing against that authority and the legacy of his father, who he never knew, and Viper and how he knew his father, like all of that, you presume he would have gone to the other side and there will be, much as I imagine, like Creed, there would be a young pilot who he's mentoring and trying to get to toe the line and save the world at the same time.
Is Maverick a ghost in this scenario?
Maverick's a ghost.
A baby fighting ghost.
Just with ghosts.
I don't know. I don't know about this one. I'm not sure they should go back to that well. I think maybe she'll leave well alone. And if they were to remake or sequelize a Cruise film from the mid '80s, then why not The Color of Money? Eh? Have another hustler movie in that franchise.
So who would you cast as the Tom Cruise role if Tom Cruise is in the Paul Newman role?
Peter Ebdon. He's a snooker player.
Okay.
Right. Dan, there's some good news this week for you.
Oh, what is it, Chris?
Terry Gilliam has finally wrapped filming on The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
Oh, yes.
That's exciting, isn't it?
Oh, yes. It's happening.
I mean,
it's really. Although there was that kind of that joke that he deleted it by accident.
just a joke, guys.
He deleted it off his hard drive by accident. I still can't quite believe it's real. But it's interesting because it is a different film. It is a different film to the
original. How do you know, Dan?
I'm not sure I can say.
Yeah.
But
if you were to know someone who had been set to that.
If I knew someone who knew something about this film, it's moved on. It's a new script and it's a really interesting kind of a twist on the original idea.
Wow.
I'm really intrigued. And Adam Driver as well in the lead role that was once kind of Johnny Depp, but it's kind of a different role now. I think that's very enticing casting.
Who's the old fella?
You see, that is now Jonathan Pryce.
No.
Who, of course, was Sam Lowry in Brazil.
Yes.
And has worked with Terry a few times. So Jonathan Pryce is now Quixote. Aviato. Quixote. He's Quixote, which is great. But, I mean, it's crazy the number of people that nearly played Quixote. I mean, Michael Palin was going to do it. Robert Duvall was going to do it.
Right.
Obviously, Jean Rochefort was the original one. And they all come through. I thought we'd end up with Terry playing Quixote himself.
Well, there you go. There you go.
But in a way, he is Quixote, and he always has been.
It's a shame that you weren't on set and don't know anything about this movie.
I know, right?
Yeah, thank God you know someone who was.
I know, exactly. This is the thing. I am on the inside track of the person on the inside track.
Yeah. Speaking of Tom Cruise, not that we were, but we were 5 minutes ago, the American Made trailer came out this week, and I thought it looks really fun. It looks really interesting and unusual. This is the Doug Liman-directed film about a man called Barry Seal, who was a gunrunner and drug smuggler involved with the CIA and Pablo Escobar's Medellin cartel in the 1980s. Look up his Wikipedia entry if you want to spoil the film for yourself. But this looks like a very much in-your-face, comedic, irreverent retelling of a very interesting life. What did we make of it?
I first saw a little bit of footage from this probably about 18 months ago now, and I was really taken aback by it. We'd heard very little about it. It's Cruise as kind of you've never seen him. And obviously we know he has kind of levity. And I'm sure we'll get onto that soon when we're talking about the Mummy. But he's really great. And there's a touch of Inherent Vice about it visually. Really interesting story about this real life guy. I'm actually really excited for this film. And when I first saw the footage, I was really excited because I felt like I hadn't seen Tom Cruise play quite this character before. And we've seen a lot of kind of similarities with a lot of the action stuff he's been doing recently. And this felt like such a departure and such an interesting story. And we've actually got an interview with Doug Liman in the next issue of Empire where he talks about how him and Tom actually prepared for this film. And they kind of went spectacularly hands-on. You'll have to get the next issue to see what I'm talking about. But they really kind of threw themselves into it in terms of a little bit of method for this film. So I think it looks really, really great, and I can't wait to actually see it. Has it been dated yet? It's September, right?
Around then, yeah. August, I think, actually, is when it's coming out. So that's all very, very exciting. News this week as well of vaguely comic book related movie stuff. James Mangold, director of Logan, is going to direct an English language remake of Disorder, which is based on the 2015 thriller, which starred Matthias Schoenaerts and Diane Kruger. I don't know whether he's going to do that after The Force, which is his ostensibly his next movie as well. That's exciting. And news, of course, Wonder Woman did incredibly well at the box office worldwide last weekend. Made $100 million in its opening weekend, which is great. Intrigued to see how it's holding up. But this week it's doing very, very well at the box office with really, really great daily intakes. So, news came in this week that Robin Wright as Antiope, last seen, of course, on Themyscira in Wonder Woman, is going to show up in Justice League, along with maybe a couple of other people, including Connie Nielsen. So we might see some of the Amazons again. How do we feel about that? How is that going to work? I'm not going to give any spoilers for the film, but how's it going to work? Are we excited?
So excited. Mm-hmm. We talked about this on the spoiler special,
yes,
the
indeed.
Wonder Woman spoiler special, but they were one of my favourite parts of Wonder Woman. The whole first kind of half an hour on... Help me say it, Chris.
Themyscira.
Themyscira was some of my favourite bits of the film. I thought she was spectacular, especially. How is that going to work?
I don't know how it's going to work.
It's hurting my brain.
Yeah, it's very intriguing. I don't know whether it's going to be flashbacks or whether she's going to show up in the modern day. Who knows? It's all very, very exciting. What I do hope is that we get another amazing pointing scene. I forgot to talk about this in the podcast, the Spoiler Special podcast, but my favourite thing about Wonder Woman is a scene right at the beginning where there's a training montage on Themyscira, and Robin Wright just wanders over to her second-in-command, and they just pointed things for what seems like 45 seconds. They just pointed something. Oh, what about her? Yes, she is good. Train her harder. Yes, I will. I will train her harder. Thank you, General Robin Wright. And it's one of those bits where you can imagine Patty Jenkins going, look, this is not going to be in the film, Robin, but if you just go over and point at something, we'll put it in later on what you're pointing at, and just say something just to get us through. And then they were running short and they went, shit, we have to put it in. Bollocks. Anyway, it's great. Great bit of sequence.
Oh, she's more, great. She just gave so much heart to Wonder Woman and so much emotion in Wonder Woman. I'll take flashbacks. I'll take reincarnation. You know, I'll take rebirth, whatever's going, really.
Whatever's happening, it's all good.
Maybe
it's
she's
all good.
The baddie.
Uh-oh. Dun, dun, dun.
No!
We shall see. Maybe she's fighting babies as a ghost. Oh, that seems to be the way everything's happening these days. Right, so I will point out as well, as we talked about it, the Wonder Woman spoiler special should be up by the time you're listening to this. We listened to you guys. As you know, we have a code that we follow here in the podcast. If we don't get to talk to the director of a movie, we don't do a spoiler special. But obviously, Patty Jenkins was unable to come to the UK for this. So that was special circumstance number one. Special circumstance number two, you guys asked for a spoiler special with just us talking about it. So that's what you're going to get. And you're welcome. And be careful what you wish for. And that is out now as well, so do listen to that. And our Mummy spoiler special is going to be up on Monday or Tuesday with the writer and director Alex Kurtzman talking about that as well. Right, time now for our second guest this week. She is an Oscar-winning actress who just happens to have a movie out in the same week as the reboot of her 1999 blockbuster, The Mummy. Now that is counter-programming. She is, of course, the wonderful Rachel Fies, who stars in this week's My Cousin Rachel, based on the Daphne du Maurier novel. John Nugent went along to talk to her, and be warned, his mic kept cutting out. So you'll get I'm calling her Nugent. But Rachel Weisz, absolutely stone cold perfect. Amazing. But John Nugent, egghead. Off, Dan. Anyway, here's Rachel Weisz.
We are delighted to welcome to the Empire Podcast, Rachel Weisz. How are you?
Well, how are you?
Yes, very good. We are here to talk about My Cousin Rachel, which is it's an adaptation of a Daphne du Maurier book. How would you describe it for someone who's not familiar with that sort of material?
Daphne du Maurier writes, I hadn't actually read it before I did this, but she writes very real page turners, like Hitchcock turned her one of her other books, Rebecca, into a very famous film. So they're dark, gothic, suspenseful stories, often with a really good twist. So yeah, she's got a good plot in her, Daphne du Maurier.
Yeah, you play a slightly mysterious character who's sort of grieving, but until the end, we don't really know her true intentions, I suppose. What's it like playing such an ambiguous character? How does that inform... Are you sort of conscious of the audience's expectations?
I didn't know the extent to which the audience, as it turns out, so people have told me, are kind of searching her face for clues. Mm. Like you as the audience go, you're a kind of Sherlock Holmes trying to figure out, well, did she or didn't she? I mean, is she a manipulative femme fatale who's killed her husband and is poisoning this young man in order to steal his wealth? Or is she just a very misunderstood, quite radical woman who's very sexually liberated and the men around her in the 19th century are threatened by her, you know, sexual freedom and her disrespect for marriage or for, you know, the idea perhaps she should earn her own living, shock horror, or not become a possession through marriage? And is she misunderstood? And is she just vulnerable and seeking a safe harbour? And trying to get over the death of her husband whilst at the same time being very sexually liberated. So it's whether you can handle that.
Yeah.
can you handle a woman in mourning who's also sexually liberated? That's my question to you. Or is she a guilty, evil poisoner? Which is her tea just, you know, good for you? Or is it because she's like an early herbalist, you know?
Yes.
She's a homeopath.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying, I decided which way, if she was good or evil, but I didn't tell the director and he didn't want me to tell him. He wanted it. So it was a secret from him. So yeah, the audience seems to be arguing quite, either they're not sure, which sounds like you're ambivalent.
Yeah.
Oh, some people are like, she's definitely guilty. Or people said, no, she's completely innocent and totally misunderstood. So it's making people argue.
There's something quite powerful about this character in that she's very strong and independent and at a time when women often weren't strong and independent. Was that something that appealed to you?
Well, the book was written in the 1950s, but set 100 years earlier. So, yeah, she has... It gives a kind of... It's like an edgy modern take on a classic period drama in that she's got quite modern ideas for her time.
Yeah.
On the same day that My Cousin Rachel is out, there's a remake of The Mummy, which is obviously, you know, this is a franchise that you were in.
I had something to do with that. Other franchise, yeah.
I mean, first of all, how does it feel to see a film that you were in being remade sort of a few years later?
I'll go and see it, and then we could talk about it. It'd be part of the conversation. I haven't seen it. I mean, it's up. You know, everything's up for grabs. People should still tell stories about whatever they want, I suppose. Yeah.
What's your? I mean, looking back now, what are your memories of that shoot? Because that was, I suppose, your first Hollywood breakthrough.
It was hot,
yes,
and sandy, and there were sandstorms and camel races. It was an extraordinary experience. And looking back on the films, I remain incredibly proud of them. I think they're very escapist and entertaining and have a lot of charm. I particularly like the first one. It was an amazing experience. I mean, none of us knew that we were going to be in a film that people would still be talking about nearly 20 years later, but it really stayed with people. I meet like new generations of kids growing up and teenagers who find it and love it, and it seems to really like touch people, so that's a lovely thing. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
I mean, a lot of actors are being snapped up by these big franchises like Marvel and Star Wars. Are those the sort of things that you would ever be interested in, or you tend to avoid that sort of thing?
I'm not avoiding anything. I'm just like reading what comes to me and then deciding. Yeah, I haven't got a rule book.
No.
Yeah.
There's no sort of big plan or anything.
It's all... No, I think anyone who tells you they've got one is either fibbing or deluded. I don't know. I'm self-employed, so things can only happen as they get written. I don't know what the future holds. And it's not like a job where you can see how the future's going to be. I can't anyway. Maybe some people care. I shouldn't have said people are deluded. Maybe people have got it all worked out.
Yeah. The reason I bring it up is just because your recent work, you've gravitated to some really interesting directors and really interesting material. Like The Lobster, for example, is just a fascinating film and just really unique.
Mm.
What was that experience like? What's it like working with Yorgos Lanthimos? Because you're doing another film with him. I just
finished it. Yeah, we just finished a film called The Favourite, which is set in England in 1708. It's new for him in that it's not a universe that he's completely made up in his imagination. It is about Queen Anne and the Duchess of Marlborough and young girl Abigail Masham, who comes to the court of Queen Anne. And there, it's a historical film, but with his own Yorgosian take on it.
Yeah. So what is it like working in that Yorgosian style then?
Not like anything else. Yeah. You can't really put it into words. It's just different, very, very different.
Yeah,
sorry, it's not really explainable. It's just Yorgosian. Mm-hmm.
And what else have you got?
The next film I've got coming out is called The Mercy, which James Marsh directed with opposite Colin Firth. And it's the story of Donald Crowhurst, who was not a professional sailor, who in the early 60s decided to sail around the world in a professional race. It's a true story. And then after that, I did a film with the Chilean director Sebastian Lillo. He has a film out this year in Spanish called Fantastic Woman. And that's opposite Rachel McAdams and Alessandra Nivola. It's called Disobedience.
Oh, well, best of luck.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, time now for this week's reviews. That was Rachel Fiske. Let's start with a movie that she is not in, which is The Mummy.
Oh, so, yes.
This is, of course, the remake of the remake of the remake of the remake. And this is about the big bloke with the bandages running around scaring people, right?
Except it's not a bloke.
What?
No. No, you see, you always thought it was weird that an undead bloke would be called a mummy. Well, not anymore. Not okay. Anymore. So this is the launch of the Dark Universe, as it's now called. And we're certain of that because it actually it says that there's a whole ident for the Dark Universe now, isn't mm-hmm. there? The whole universal globe goes and then it goes dark and then it says Dark Universe at the front. So it's like...
They have someone going, please. So they pop up with their fingers crossed going, like it, please.
Well, look, I think, you know, you were joking, but actually I was pleasantly surprised by this film. I mean, it's hokey. But it doesn't take itself too seriously at all.
I think you just described yourself, Dan.
Thank you. No. I was going to say I'm more cokey than hokey, but that would be a very foolish thing to say.
Wow.
So,
because you put your left leg in, your left leg out.
Yeah.
Well, I do more of the shake it all about, really, to be honest. I put my whole self in.
Okay, bye. Dan. Let's talk about The Mummy, which stars Thomas Cruise Mapother the Fourth.
That's correct. The third, isn't it?
Fourth.
Is he the fourth? He's the fourth already. Yeah, the fourth. Wow, how time flies.
Yeah, he gave birth himself. He was the third, but then he had a ghost bait. Anyway, yes.
So it's actually good fun. It's hokey fun. It's kind of got a bit of the vibe of the Brendan Fraser and Stephen Sommers mummy movie. It doesn't take itself too seriously. A little mm-hmm. bit of a kind of boys-only kind of adventure thing, especially near the start. But they've gone 15 certificate with it, so it has some stronger horror elements than you might have expected. So he plays Nick Morton, who is a long-range reconnaissance expert, and he's also what he calls a liberator of precious antiquities, right?
I read he's a paramilitary archaeologist.
No, he's not an archaeologist.
No?
Okay.
Annabelle Wallace's character is the archaeologist here.
Okay.
No, he's just a guy who's basically bombing around Iraq, right? And wherever there's insurgents kind of like laying waste to antiquities, he sort of clears the site and then he gets the antiquities out and then makes money out of it on the side. But unwittingly, he uncovers or discovers an ancient Egyptian tomb. What's that doing in Iraq? It's in Iraq for a very good reason, because what's in that tomb is so bad and evil and powerful that they didn't bury it in Egypt at all. They went all the way to Iraq and dumped it there. And is Sofia Boutella as Amanet, the mummy. And what she wants to do, because she's not dead, she wants to bring back the evil god of death, Set, who is actually the devil these days, except in her time he was known as Set. In order to do this, she needs a male vessel, okay, who will be the body into which this dark god will enter. In order to do that, she needs to stab this male with a magic dagger that has a magic stone in the top of it. Tom Cruise is that vessel.
Wow.
Are you with me? Follow up?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good.
That's a good old big slab of plot there.
Yes, exactly. And that's not all of it. I mean, there's big slabs of exposition right at the start of the film.
All right.
But anyway, so then it sort of turns into a chase thing where she's trying to get hold of Tom and trying to get him to, you know, basically be her vessel. which has a kind of odd side effect of turning the film into a kind of strange sort of creepy stalker girlfriend movie, which was surprising. I wasn't expecting that.
Okay. So,
yeah.
And you liked it?
It's good fun. I mean, it's look, you can pick holes in it. You can, you know, you can, the plot's nonsense, but it's good fun. It whips along at a nice pace. It's got some fun action in it. Mm-hmm. Tom is on buoyant form here. He's kind of like lots of grinning and wisecracking. So, yeah, it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun. It's one of those leave your brain at the door kind of films, to use a cliche.
Oh, okay. That's all films for me. Terry, what did you think?
So I think it's really slick, really polished, actually really funny at times. I think I laughed out loud 4 times, which is quite a rarity for me. It's not that I'm dead inside, it's just it doesn't often come out of my mouth.
Oh, these were parts you were meant to laugh out loud?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah. Yes.
It's like someone dying on screen and going, ha, ha, ha.
However, it's fucking batshit crazy, right? So it is full out there craziness. There's a bit very near the beginning where you just have to suspend disbelief. And once you've done that, as Dan says, it's actually quite enjoyable because it has a lovely levity and cruises on actually really brilliant form. And the action is great. And it's actually, I think there's going to be some division over the horror elements and whether it's scary enough, because I think some people may feel the horror has been sacrificed at the expense of action, potentially. Mm-hmm. But there is one bit, and this isn't a spoiler, but just to say when she's, you know, becoming the mummy again or is coming out of the grave, which there is a sequence which I found genuinely really scary. And I have to say, Sophie Boutella is incredible in this film. She has a physicality about her, which means she's really magnificent at times on screen. There is very awkward stuff around kind of how fetishized she is, for sure. I think that's kind of probably something that people are going to really pick up on. And I think the other female character, Annabelle Wallis, who we've already mentioned, she's essentially like walking exposition. She's there to kind of, you know, just going to explain what this bit of the plot is about, that you have no idea what's going on. And she's very plucky and blonde and blue-eyed. And so right. the women are very archetypal. If you know an undead mummy who's seeking a vessel for the actualization of the root of all evil. So I think that the female characters are quite problematic, and I think neither of them have much agency, and he is ultimately the vessel which she seeks, and she spends, as Dan says, she spends the entire thing chasing him around, and it is very much, you know, this is never going to work out. Oh, stop stalking me. Stop stalking me, you crazy supernatural being.
So it's like a really big budget version of It Follows. Is it, in a way? She's always turning up wherever he goes. He's on the bog, and there she is.
Kind of, but she's in his head, and there's a bit where it's, I mean, and this is where you kind of do have to suspend disbelief, because you've suddenly got this psychic disruption happening, and he's kind of part soothsayer. It becomes very weird very quickly, and at that point you go, I'm going to strap myself in and ride this one out, and it is. I had a very enjoyable time watching this film, but it doesn't hold up to close examination. There are massive holes. I came out with so many questions about, well, what does that mean? And what does that mean, obviously, for the greater universe that they're clearly trying to build? But
I suspect they don't know.
Well, and that's the concern, right? But yeah. I think if you are looking for a kind of mindless romp in the cinema for 2.5 hours, then there are worse ways to spend your money.
How's Rusty Crowe?
Well, yeah, he's quite important to this whole Dark Universe thing, actually. And I wasn't sure how spoilery this would be to mention, but he is actually listed in the cast as Dr. Jekyll.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's been out for months.
So, you know, there you go. But he is I enjoyed him, actually. Cruise is having fun, and Crow's clearly having fun. So he appears as Dr. Jekyll, who kind of is the boss of this super secret organisation based under the Natural History Museum.
Prodigium.
Yes, exactly. And it's got the thing where Cruise walks through and there's a jar with a Gilman hand in it. And there's a jar with a vampire, Dracula skull, Dracula monster skull, you know. And
Gavin's going, please get me out of here.
and they put most of the exposition actually into Russell Crowe's mouth, except it's Dr. Jekyll saying it. And when he's Dr. Jekyll, he's terribly posh. He's extremely posh. And then of course, there's a little transformation.
No.
And he goes all, you know, pork pie. Pork pie scenario.
There's a lot of pork pie happening in this podcast tonight. I like it, mate.
But it's a really fun scene, actually. And actually, I call me shallow, but I got a bit of a thrill out seeing Tom Cruise and Russell Crowe sharing a scene and having a big old fight.
Who wouldn't? You're not alive if you don't get a thrill from that.
Yeah.
Three stars in for The Mummy. And Terry, I know you're a huge fan of Berlin Syndrome. Tell us about that.
Yes, yeah, so I saw this at Glasgow Film Festival back in February. And it's Kate Shortland's third feature. And it's essentially the story of this Aussie traveller, young woman who's in Berlin. Starts off very kind of, it feels like a coming of age story. She's there, she's travelling around, she's doing it alone. And then she meets this dreamy teacher in the street. They share strawberries at a traffic crossing. They go home together, back to his house. It's very important to say. They look at Klimt books. They, you know, it's all the kinds of trappings of a lovely hipster romance. Until after their one night stand, she wakes up and she's locked in his house. And it's only on the second day of being locked in his house, I don't know, call me crazy, I'd probably notice on the first day, that she realises that she's being held hostage. So it's in many ways, you know, it's not a novel setup in terms of cinema to have this female hostage story. But the way it's presented is actually really different, because I think normally in these scenarios, the roles are really clearly defined, which is very much a vulnerability and a victim status on the female side. The male characters are often very kind of typified, really kind of certain types of characters. This guy is a teacher. He's fairly handsome. Mm-hmm. And the great thing is you don't see it all from her point of view. So it moves out of the apartment she's being held. And you see the normality of his life. And he lives a banal, genteel, middle-class, lovely life in Berlin. And it's contrasted with her kind of being locked in their apartment. But also the kind of nuanced relationship they have between, you know, is she truly a victim? At which point does she consent? Does she develop feelings for him? It really delves into those grey areas.
So presumably the title is referenced to Stockholm Syndrome in some
way. Yes, that's right. And but it doesn't go as far as Stockholm Syndrome, and that's what's great about it, is it would have been easy to kind of paint a picture of a girl who falls in love with her captor. But Teresa Palmer, who plays the lead, actually does it with such brilliant reservation that you can't even as an audience member really get inside where she is on the situation. Mm. I really love this film because of the nuance, because of the grey areas. I think she puts in an amazing performance. The psychological ambiguity is really interesting to me. The fact it's not really typical kind of this weird male-female kind of dichotomy. There isn't that sense of it being a really straight down the line black and white depiction of this kind of terrible situation. So I very much enjoyed this film. We gave it 4 stars from Empire, and yeah, it's definitely out of Kate Shortland's films. She's done a couple before. I know Dan, I loved Somersault.
Yeah. That's years ago now, though. Yeah. But, that was a gorgeous film.
Yeah. And she's not known for kind of doing these big, easy, mass-market films. Mm. This is probably the most accessible out of her films yet. So if you haven't kind of experienced Kate Shortland before, this is probably a good point in. But yeah, I definitely recommend.
Amazing. Fantastic. One. 4 stars then for Berlin Syndrome. And that is pretty much all the time we have to discuss this week's releases, I'm afraid. But I will say that also out this week, obviously, is My Cousin Rachel. We gave that 3 stars, Rachel Weisz and Sam Claflin and Roger Michel directing.
That's correct.
Yes, indeed. Roger Mitchell or Roger Michel?
I would say Roger Michel.
Correct. and also
Roger Mitchell.
Roger Mitchell.
Pork pie.
Dear God. And also out is Wilson, the Woody Harrelson movie, which we gave 3 stars too. Stuart Hazeldine's A Shack, that got 2 stars. And then the Michael Sheen, Richard Gere film, what we talked about earlier on, Norman, that got 4 stars as well. And it is really, really good. So you should check that out also. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by, I think if my calendar's correct, Lily Collins, Lily Collins will be here, which is all very, very exciting indeed. Also, look out for the Wonder Woman spoiler special, which should be with you right now, and the Mummy spoiler special coming to a crypt near you soon. Please do book tickets to see us live at the London Podcast Festival on September 16th. That'll be awesome. We'll have a very special guest. I hope. That's going to be very exciting. Until then, it's goodbye from Terry.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Dan.
Farewell, sir.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to carefully, quietly, gently replace Mark Rylance's pork pie hat back in his head without him noticing.
Very sorry about the pork pie, Mark. Didn't mean to knock it off your head, mate. All right, thanks for this lead. Bye.